Welcome to the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast. Here, we speak with extraordinary games industry professionals and listen to their story to learn all about what they've built and who they are. GamesNet Berlin Europe is the international games industry initiative of MediaNet Berlin Brandenburg, the networking association for the media, creative and digital industries in Germany's capital region. My name is Simon Oler, and I will be your host for this program. Today, we are speaking with Hervik Egon Casadoro Kopp, or in short, HECK, H-E-C-K, and he's the CEO of Normalum Mixed Realities. The description for his company is enabling learning through meaningful stories, interaction, knowledge, and emotions, connecting the dots between cultures with immersive media, and aiming to grow self-efficacy and foster personal evolution of players through technology and narrative interaction design. We are speaking about storytelling, of course, what is happening in the world, how Hervik chose or forged his own path in university, and what he found meaningful on his journey. We also end up at the I Ching, a Chinese tool for divination, which is one of my favorite topics, so I'm very happy about that. It's a whole journey. We go deep and through many places, so we hope you enjoy that. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy our conversation with Hervik Egon Casadoro Kopp, or HECK. Have fun.
Hello and welcome to the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast with my beautiful co-host Simon.
Hello, thank you very much.
And our guest today is Hervik Egon Casadoro Kopp, CEO of Normalum Mixed Realities, which he describes as enabling learning through meaningful stories, interaction, knowledge and emotions, connecting the dots between cultures with immersive media and aiming to grow self-efficacy and foster personal evolution of players through technology and narrative interaction design.
Quite the description.
Oh, yeah. He's been active in the fields of cross-media, serious games and narrative design for well over 10 years. And we met at a maze in Berlin around 2017 or 18 for the first time. Since then, he was a guest and speaker at my conference, Game On, in Vilnius, where I worked before coming to MediaNet here. And now we reconnect here on the podcast after he's relocated to Venedig, Venice, actually, in English. And I'm eager to hear what he's doing and how his life has been. So welcome, Hervik, and tell us what's going on with you at the moment.
Well, thanks for having me. Thanks for the invitation. Spreading out some casual talk about, I hope not only myself, but interesting themes for all of us. Let me not correct, but kind of expand a little bit on where I am. Yes, it's true. At the moment, actually, I'm really in Venice, Venezia, but I'm going back and forth, so I'm not totally lost to Berlin. Don't worry. You might say I'm the last European. Of course, I'm not the only one who might want to claim that title. It's not a title. It's just given to anybody who is European and travels maybe in between countries. Look at this. So I'm also in Vienna because I'm born in Austria. So I'm visiting my family very often too. And these three countries are all in Europe as far as I know. So joyfully doing exactly that right now.
Right. And we usually start off with like topics that you are interested in at the moment or that are on your mind. So if there's anything that you are working on at the moment or that's like currently occupying a lot of your headspace, that's a good entry to start. So tell us if there's something like that.
Sure. Can you tell me again, is the subtitle of your podcast, it's GamesNet Berlin. .eu, right?
So it's that's our URL as well.
And the subtitle of it, the real full title is
of our podcast.
Yeah,
GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast.
Ah, okay. Because there's an important word in it, which comes to my mind as an answer to your question. So it's Europe, and not in the maybe a little bit less prominent and more kind of. Europe is there, but, you know, what does it do? what is good for way of thinking, but more of Europe became very important in the last kind of 2.5 months because we feel, many Europeans feel that this war, which we are experiencing here for the first time in Europe, also that can be challenged, of course. Looking to the war in the wars plural in Yugoslavia or the war in the Kurdish areas of three countries actually. Mm-hmm. So there is a there was still a lot of war ongoing, but our perception of it was that in Europe there was peace for 75 years, and this is gone now. Mm-hmm. This deeply affects me. This affects maybe all of us. And yes, it might also have a place in a podcast, which is about kind of maybe games and fun stuff, lighthearted things, and the joyful escapism, which sometimes is attributed to producing and engaging in games. Mm-hmm. So Europe and our geopolitical kind of troubles, which boiled up, which probably are not just the last 2.5 months, the illusion of being safe in Europe, whatever that means, the buildup of it in the last 8 years or even more, and our blind eye, even as Europeans, to all that is definitely a theme. Yeah, we just have to kind of switch on radio on television or go on the interwebs to check what different polarized things people are throwing around and how insecure the world has become for let's say kind of privileged middle class European games producer or player. Mm-hmm. what are we playing here?
Yeah,
on the world stage is a big question for me right now.
And since I mean your company is called Normalum, mm-hmm. and is about mixed realities, so mm-hmm. I mean this war is currently basically our reality, although still as being based in Germany, of course, it's another reality still than being based in Ukraine, yeah. or countries that are right next to it. Mm. But I assume that from knowing you and like having spoken to you before, you are somebody who deeply thinks about these kinds of topics, and this always also, as it affects our reality, it also affects your work, I would assume. Have you already like had time to, let's say, digest and take this into what you do, and maybe also explain a little bit like what you do at the moment right now, so people get a grasp of what that is?
And I will put a little question on top of it also, because this is quite the opening, and I'm immediately curious. Yes, you're describing the reality that is happening. What does that mean to you, in addition to Florian's questions? Because yeah, it's happening, it affects all of us. What does that really mean? So let's maybe talk about what that means to you, why you are opening this podcast with this. I think that would be interesting as well.
Yeah. Well, I'm scared. with a slightly uncomfortable laughter after it. I'm scared of this situation. This situation of a imminent or possible third world war, nuclear strikes, sorry, I was young enough in the 80s to kind of have gotten a part of that kind of nuclear threat. It can go wrong tomorrow, including the Chernobyl disaster, which of course is more the side of using the nuclear energy in safe ways, which went very wrong there. And it was the Ukraine. It was in nearby Kiev, in Chernobyl, where also I as a child got affected by that somehow. That was a sort of normal for me. And this normal of still thinking that history has ended. I'm not very fond of this kind of quotation, but some people were kind of saying that history ends. The West has won, or at least democracy has won, or a certain kind of system has won. Whatever that might mean is. Those people and kind of those memories of a normal of more and more security and going further away from possible conventional wars or a nuclear war, this kind of normality has been shattered for at least kind of 3 months now since the invasion. But I think it was in peril already beforehand, but I didn't fully see it, or I wasn't kind of wanting to look there in depth. So if you ask me if you insinuate that I'm thinking deeply about that, I'm not an expert in geopolitics or international relations. I had to read up a lot of stuff. So I'm thinking as much as I can about this right now, even though it's not my theme, and I wouldn't call me at all an expert. But at least one thing I could put on the banner, and that is I'm a big fan of complex problems. And complexity in itself, I think that our brain is made to digest a lot of clues and form a picture, or at least kind of find patterns. And here that's what I'm trying to do, trying to find patterns, and that might lead to an assessment also personally. What you ask me, what Simon, what how does it affect me personally? Well, first I have to digest that normality is broken. Like Jimmy McGonigal said, reality is broken. I think no, it's normality is broken, and I was beforehand already sure that normality doesn't exist. Normal is fiction, so that's why I called my company Normalum, because I think that we are always negotiating, we're always changing that kind of normal. It is just a snapshot of our only an individual snapshot in a society which creates its norms and changes its norms, its viewpoints. So, and yes, we are living in a mixed reality, which is now heavily influenced by pictures which are utterly gruesome. Surprise, dear European, that's me now. War was always like that. So it's absolutely horrifying, how that looks, the aesthetics of destruction, that the charred blocks where hives of where people, families live, which are kind of, you know, known like that kind of all over the world, and as every day as if this is gone in a blink, there could be a missile being hit, there's a fire breaking out, the whole thing looks like a piece of coal afterwards, people stumbling around in their half torn apart kitchens, and pieces of their normality, of their neighbors lying around on the ground. And we are not saved from these pictures. Do we need to be saved from these pictures? Well, boof. Again, we are constructing, and that's part of my interest in general, we are constructing our world, I think, with storytelling, with all media means at our hands, which then through our world building in our heads becomes our reality, but it's first fiction. So what we see becomes our accepted norm, our accepted that's what it is right now. And then later on, I'm always simplifying, a memory, which is being categorized as this, it was like this then. And of course, it never was like this. Only we remember parts of it. Maybe some pictures, maybe smells, and so on. So the all together in a synesthetic form makes the pattern. And this pattern is part of the world we construct, and we can talk about with language. So if you ask me what changed, I think also my language changed. I'm trying to find ways how to express these kind of impressions which we get bombarded with. Luckily here in Europe, here in in the middle of Europe, meaning kind of, let's say, Germany, let's say kind of Austria or Italy. Not yet with real bombs. But that is a possibility, and this kind of possibility to reevaluate the possible ephemeral sense of security every day, maybe in minutes even, that is something deeply disturbing, and I'm not sure how to kind of turn this into something productive yet, honestly.
Yeah.
I'm mouth open in big parts, and I'm trying to rationalize things. I'm trying to look at history, engaging in conversations like with you now. But do I know already what to do with that? Probably not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. All right. It's hard to somehow find a segue from that and to,
hitting your
to agree. You know, to respectfully, I get why,
I'm
why
so
it's
sorry.
Funny, but,
I'm so
but like no, it's to, funny. Why like I would like to respect the topic,
sure,
but
sure,
I
sure.
also want to don't want to dwell on it. So
yeah,
it's
yeah,
it's
that,
hard to
danger.
Find
sure.
the perfect segue for it. So yeah, but. Yes, of course, just saying from my point of view as well, for me also, and I think for everybody, reality has changed. And I think I contacted you for two reasons quite recently about being on the podcast, which number one, usually my first thought is, oh, I haven't talked to person X in quite a while. Let's see what they're up to. And for many people, I just follow on socials and then I see all the pictures and like you are very active on Instagram, like posting Venice and Italy pictures.
Beautiful,
so
beautiful.
Very beautiful pictures. Mm-hmm. So I always
it's not reality. Think, it's just
yeah, yeah, exactly.
Storytelling.
Social media is not reality, people. Yeah, but yeah, just wondering. So what's going on with Eric? And then of course, yeah. So this definition of reality and your history of working in this field and like bending or shaping reality through media. So yeah, I thought it would be a good time to talk to you again. And
and you expected that the lighthearted having yeah. to kind of just make some fun remarks about it. And look what you've got yourself into.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah,
I have a segue, by the way, guys. I have something. You too?
Yeah, but go on. I remember.
Let's see. I was thinking we could talk about normality. For mm-hmm. me, that's the theme of the things we talked about for now. Because, like we said, your company is called that. You mentioned it now. I think I have an interesting take on normality. We just talked about social media, which has a very interesting and strange relation to normality or reality. So maybe that's a place where we want to go. What were you thinking about, Eric? Maybe we can like combine our thoughts.
Exactly. Maybe you first. The comparison of what's happening right now is sometimes being put into the realm of games too. So some kind of said early on, this attack is sort of a chess game, you know, kind of, you have to kind of move the pieces. And I have a remark of Garry Kasparov, who is a dissident now and not living in Russia anymore, who is as a chess master dissecting this and saying something else, which I found very interesting. So I'm putting it back into the games and games area, if you will. So pick it up or not.
Yeah, yeah. Go from there. So what is Kasparov saying and why is this a game? And I think that has absolutely to do with normality. So let's go on your thread.
Cool. Okay. Kasparov wrote a book already, I think it was 2015, about Putin, and he was very critical about him. So again, he's a dissident now and one of the most known names in chess. And in an interview recently, he was asked, okay, what is going on? How would you describe it? And he said, for me, so I'm paraphrasing, of course. What Putin does right now is actually not a game of chess. He's not a chess player, because the game of chess has a certain condition here, and you see all the pieces on the board. Both of the sides do see all the pieces. There are rules which are being kept to kind of make the game work out. In his view, he said Putin is actually a poker player. So he holds some cards and the major game mechanic in there is the bluff. Mm-hmm. So it's not chess. And if that comes from a authority in chess, I'm just kind of believing it. I found that kind of an interesting viewpoint, so that we are not kind of also the planning of it, the positioning of the pieces. But there's a major flaw in it, because you don't see all the pieces. Also, we don't see all the pieces. We are just getting the mediated ones, the ones through media. We don't know what's actually really going on the ground, and we don't know. Maybe luckily, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. So, what efforts, diplomatic efforts, calls, failed efforts, and so on and so on. So all these things would be probably totally overwhelming, and that might be better characterized as a poker game.
And I think that's also the thing with normality and games. Of course, there's a bit of a perversion in saying, well, this is a game, but then you certainly won't feel like this is a game, aka game always has a connotation of, well, not serious, it's just an overlay, fun, kind of a mediated way of experiencing reality, so we can interact in a different, let's say, meaning sphere. That's often, I think, what a game is. And of course, somebody who just had to leave their house because a rocket fell into it, oops, and now they are in somebody else's basement or something, they would say, how dare you call this a game? Or say, well, if that's a game, I never chose to participate in it. Because like you described also with chess, a chess game also is a mutual expression of respect.
And also,
intellectual destruction and dominance, if you will, but that comes second. Both have agreed in that, like in any fight. Mm. And so, this whole narrative that you're bringing up of, is this a game? Is this normal? I have varying thoughts on that. One could say, the world is always in a state of war somewhere, and this is normal. Living in extended periods of peace is not normal. I'm not really saying that. It's just like, I don't know. That's definitely a way to look at it.
Historically, probably quite accurate.
And so. I guess that's maybe also a good time to ask you about your work. Like, what do you, normally do? Like, what are you normally, as a maker, as a creator, artist, however you would describe yourself, what experience do you usually take, and how do you synthesize them, and into what? Because now it kind of came up with this big bollwerk of this topic, which is hard. We are not going to synthesize that now. It's very difficult. So I think maybe, but it definitely will now be the undercurrent of the culture of this recorded podcast episode for sure, and we will get back to it. But if we go a few steps back and go to normal, this word will also be a meme now, Hervik, like, what do you normally do? without that in mind. I think that's something that I'm very interested in, because I think, well, it's for me, as far as I've researched it, a bit hard to see, a bit opaque, a bit obscure. So I'm extra interested in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe you can talk a bit about that, and I'm sure we'll get back to the other stuff.
Well, I'm a human being, living still, breathing, eating, and pattern recognition. That's what I do the whole day. And is this professional? Well, maybe in parts, yes, because if you home in on the pattern recognition, and the result of also my studies, that fiction creates reality, then you could kind of pinpoint my professional interest and what I do to find ways to participate in the future of storytelling and learning. That doesn't mean that I'm always kind of working or that I'm always succeeding, but that is the focus which where we can segue into many things, including kind of geopolitics, but also into making games and serious games in the sense of okay, we are learning something. It stems so that I'm obeying a little bit here to the cultural undercurrent, Simon. From my studies for most, I'm a little bit of a complicated character concerning the professional or academic background. I studied cognitive neurosciences, but I started with medicine. So first medicine, then changing it into an irregular study plan. That was possible in Vienna at that time. If you take the time to put it together, after the Bologna process, I think the students now who might hear that would say, what the fuck? You're spending 4 years to put together an irregular study plan and through four juries so that the university says, yeah, you can study this, what do you call it, cognitive neuroscience, stemming from psychology, philosophy, medicine, and biology. Okay, you can do this now. I did then and finished that and didn't become a doctor.
Did you say forgeries? Did I hear that right?
Four areas, yes.
Oh, okay. I thought, sorry, no.
Okay. Maybe
I thought you said you created some forgeries to create your own.
You can call this forgery because I forged together really by force, going there kind of and being very insistent. So say, okay, I want to do this. Please, dear professor, look at it and tell me if I need something from your field, which is not now part of this. And I want to do principally brain science, but brain science and brain research has many different fields, and there is no general professor for that. That's why I want to create a new study plan. And they were all quite patient and helpful. And after some years, I had my approved study plan so that somebody else can do it too.
Idea. That would have been a question, actually. Is that something that you did for yourself, or basically people afterwards could also do that?
No, it's a byproduct that other people can do that too. So it's called an irregular study plan. Individuelles Diplomstudium. And, that was named, in that moment, by me, cognitive neurosciences, plural, and some other people, four from different fields studied something similar. One was based, for example, in linguistics and English, mm-hmm. and called it cognitive science. Another kind of biologist, so there are different kind of approaches to that, and that was also the idea. I mean, it's kind of not one there's not one stop shop for where you get
what all was the, all what the was your will sorry what was your will at why did you put that together? Did you always invent your own stuff?
That might be one of my biggest flaws. Yeah. to stubbornly invent what was not there before. Invent is already nice. Maybe kind of forge create.
Force.
Or conjure up out of thin air. Because it's sort of the satisfaction to have then done something under apostrophes nobody. So I'm definitely not the first one who is kind of doing that. Or I was standing also on plans from study plans from the US, so mainly from Stanford, and so there were some people doing that kind of broad approach already. But it's deeply satisfying if for me at least when this kind of madness becomes sort of a norm. To kind of point
originality,
back to that.
Right?
Maybe. I just couldn't picture myself as a medical doctor, and I had some crackpots who were way more accomplished and way more versed, who also broke their kind of careers in a certain kind of way, and who advised, sort of helped, inspired. So originality. Maybe also career choice. It's not just madness. You are standing out if you're the only one doing it. So you can also definitely monopoly. And of course, I don't have a monopoly, neither on the approach nor on results. But that interests me much more than following the beaten path.
But do you think that, like, this is super interesting to me in terms of how people, you mentioned this Bologna process, stuff, and how actually, I mean, studies became more and more centralized or more streamlined.
Schoolish.
And so people now, and I've definitely had this, especially before and even in the beginning of starting with games. I mean, I come from a completely different field. We've talked about this on the podcast with other guests before, but games in general used to be, at least I think it still is, kind of open for people who come from different fields and just want to join because they bring something unique, something that nobody else has. You can mold a lot of stuff here, but like this approach of I don't want to go down this beaten path is something that people do maybe when they start a company, but I never actually have heard of people applying that already in their study time, basically saying, well, this is a field that I started, but I will like reshape my whole curriculum and like build my own new studies. That comes at an age where I think people are kind of, at least thinking about students now, really afraid of like, what will my job look like if I don't finish this course, if I don't have this and this degree. And I definitely had that at some point as well, until I just trusted myself to go my own way. But I think that's super interesting. Like, how does that process start for you?
While you were talking, I found an answer. It was not lying there already, but I think I'm deeply fascinated by things I do not know. Mm-hmm. And I'm taking it seriously. So I'm not saying, yeah, sure. That's kind of brush over it and we'll find some kind of book and or this professor says that and then that's it. I'm sort of not trusting even myself with the assessment. And I think a good student should also know that they don't get the answers. They need to be kind of going maybe deeper with some things. And the epiphany, if you will, happened in the medical dissection course when a human body lies in front of you for 3 months and you dissect the tissue. So that might be gross, but it's also deeply fascinating because there's a human being there, and this human being kind of was living, and it had all its kind of stories, histories, actually kind of, you know, inscribed in the body. But where exactly? Well, when you get to the brain, you get the brain in your hands, and then you have to dissect the brain. So you cut through the memories of people. And
wow,
that deeply moved me. Yeah, well, that's what we need to do. So there's a brain course, which is 3 weeks. I think I did it after Christmas at a certain kind of, when I was, I don't know how old I was, 21. That deeply kind of affected me and another friend of mine who we were both kind of stunned by that we did that we had to do that. And the focus was, what is that? That brain. How is it even possible to kind of, how do we didn't know, and we also didn't know who to trust to have a real answer. And the more we talked to people, the more it was clear that nobody has a real answer. So the conundrum stayed up, and I think it's still up. So there is no kind of, oh yeah, sure, that's what it is. And honestly, it may come back to this, but I would be very, it would be very disconcerting if somebody says, oh, now we have deciphered, we know exactly how the brain works. I would kind of, you know, it would be so creepy. Yeah. I would be very upset. Yeah. Yeah. Because I don't trust people with that knowledge. But then I really wanted it. I was like, oh, there must be a way how to find that now. We kind of now in 10 years that will be kind of solved. And there was also a push at the time for brain sciences, brain research. The Americans had about 10 years of a study program and poured some millions into it, thinking that after 10 years they have the answer. Nope.
Sure. Yeah. Then surely it will only be 10 years. Surely,
exactly.
Yeah.
Then in the end 90s, I think the Hjernen added the year of the brain was in Denmark. In Austria, we had also a year where they threw after also something like that. So there was a certain kind of focus on this. We are still also deeply in the AI winter. So nobody was really kind of thinking that we can model a brain at that time. It was more kind of some nerdy stuff I had to do then too, or wanted to do too. The riddle was out there, and the riddle can only be solved if you're sure you are either having or knowing where to get the answer, or you're very broad. And I think there are still a lot of things we don't know, and where a broad approach will be valuable and fruitful.
And I mean, from somebody who gives this kind of answer, I understand now how before when Simon asked you like what a normal day to you looks like, how you basically also dissect your day into like, I'm a human being, I still breathe, I eat, like it's this analytic viewpoint to a very mundane question is like sort of how I understand you to see the world now. But then from that point on, you somehow sliced through memories and thought of your own curriculum and started to go where whatever people no haven't gone before. So we are like Star Trek now. And then, so at some point we come to this also again, mundane, but maybe not like games topic or realities in games. So still like there's a connection that we still need to make somehow. So where do we end up and how do we end up there?
Well, there's another kind of step in between. There was, if you start with this kind of thinking, you are kind of doomed. You are susceptible and sensitive to things you don't know or approaches which you haven't tried before. Still homing in on one topic, but still where you're kind of, if you're really honest, you haven't tried that. So the thing which actually brought me into games, I guess, was the decision to also inscribe it or try to get into the Academy of Fine Arts. More or less at the same kind of time, while winding down medicine and trying to get this individual study plan working. Academic wise, it doesn't make sense because you either kind of finish it or not. But you have kind of a double study running in already. One was comprised by four subjects. So it's a lot to kind of take on. But I thought, okay, why not? Kind of, I love drawing. I actually had a vocational study before I started with university in a graphic design. So if you will, I'm a graphic designer. That's fine by me. But I wanted to develop that, and I thought that the artistic viewpoint might tell me something about the brain. That is sort of course, not a result based thing like science, but more kind of you look into yourself. You are trying to find expressions which are not looking like equations, which are not hypothesis versus experience and experiments to be repeated, but they are also experimental and they are very creative. And I guess we all agree what definitely we are doing. Most of us, even those who consider themselves not so creative, we are creating a lot of shit. Am I allowed to say shit?
Beep. You already,
yeah, you already did before. Yeah,
a classic. Exactly. You know, am I allowed to say beep? every day. So and we are doing it in many, many ways. So we are sort of a creative solution. Solutionist is a bad word, like barista. Problem solvers. problem solvers. Creative problem solvers. And
I'm a solutionist.
Yeah, it sounds like a bad Netflix series from the 90s. So we are doing this, and I thought that's art, or getting taught how to do art. How awkward that sounds, and it was. was a good thing to do in addition to everything else. But that brought me to the media class of Peter Kogler at the Academy of Fine Arts. As I got in, this found me interesting somehow, and then changed to the concept art class of Rene Green, an American lady who was more fitting my conceptual approach, more or less. But the media stuff was kind of being hooked into my flesh. So it was the first class there being taught with computers. So there were computers all over the place. There were sound experiments. At least kind of the direction was very, very playful. Producing kind of contemporary fine art with new technological means, and now a little bit kind of oldish media art. Yes, games were already kind of part of that. We had, three months kind of course in game history. That was fun. I loved that a lot. That stuck with me, at least after dropping out of the research and laboratory possible career path, changing it into interactive storytelling in Berlin.
Mm-hmm. So, and from that moment, you stayed in Berlin.
Exactly. So I left Vienna because of the not so very fruitful anymore cognitive science, neuroscience, brain science background. I say it because I can. Now you get it. There was at a certain point an initiative of about 100 people, 100 scientists in Austria to get a grant of 12 million euros for the next years, I think it was 5-6 years, a proposal to the government, because there was suddenly more money coming in from somewhere, it was about 600 millions, and they wanted a piece of the cake. And they called it kind of an initiative for cognitive science or cognitive neuroscience. So I knew most of the people in there. Was socialized in that field, so all was great. Three projects where I was participating already in that kind of proposal. The bad thing was the government didn't kind of want it. None of these things came to fruition. And this 100 people agglomeration of excellence in cognitive neurosciences got, and also interdisciplinary. This was interesting. They had kind of, the proposal was to need to work with two disciplines in each of the projects. Whatever you do, you need to work with not just your people, but with somebody from another field. That was mm-hmm. fantastic. I loved it. But no money, no honey. I'm so sorry. This was probably sexistic. Whoever honey is, it could be also kind of coming from the bears.
Exactly.
The bees.
And the bees probably.
Exactly. And the flowers.
The bears are the consumers. The bees are the makers. Not God, to be confused. Yes. Imagine
the bad bears.
You know, the bear honey factory. Like what would that look like? You know, very strange. And then all these bees come in to start consuming the honey. That can't be right. So
exactly.
Let's keep our facts straight. And I don't think there's anything unless you want it to be no. sexistic about no money, no honey. Because exactly. if you have no money, what are you going to do? Put in your
on your
tea?
Bread?
Like, yeah, some cheap sugar probably, but certainly no deutscher Imkerhonig from fleißigen Bienen.
Österreichischer Waldhonig.
Sure.
Yes,
you will be too broke for that. So no, I think you're right. No money, no honey is a universally true statement, and we can leave it stand okay. without worry.
Okay, good. That was the situation, and so all the neuroscience bears were looking kind of very concerned. Said, okay, what the heck? What shall we do? went on to do their own kind of things, maybe little things or more little. And I was very, very disappointed by all of it. So because there was for 5-6 years a new kind of institute for brain research in Vienna, it took 20 years to put that together. I was the last one in a department which was called neurophysiology. So it was electrophysiology there. So we did EEG studies, but the institute, or at least kind of the people running that department, didn't find the right people to continue the whole research agenda. So it was being closed down. And the rest was more medical research. And as you understood so far, I'm more interested in the broader aspects of cognition and not into ion channels nerve endings. So something very specific, very, very, very detailed. If it helps to clear some things, fantastic. So I probably can read myself into it, but the medical applications or the pathology of it is not so much my thing. And there was a big part, for example, pain research. Yes, it sounds kind of, if you think about it, sounds almost funny, but it wasn't. So the broad questions were not being dealt with there so much. And then there was this kind of thing with the grant program, which didn't come together. And I went to Berlin. So finally we're here, and I realized that there are two things in town which work out. There's the film industry. Also mm-hmm. with Potsdam, and there are the games. That seems to be strong. And of course, entertainment in general.
Yep.
Let's not forget that Berlin is a fun city, and especially also might still be. Let's see what happens after the 2 years of pandemic. We haven't kind of said the word pandemic so far, so I said it.
Thanks.
You're welcome. So one of the two, both actually sounded very interesting for me. They're much more mature than in Vienna. So the reason was really also professional to kind of go there and see what opportunities might arise.
All right, I see. And one thing that came to my mind while you were talking about this is, like, do these bears have labor unions in their fabric? Or
yeah, bear union, sure, BU.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The neuroscience bears.
You mean. Yeah, they also create self-help programs, because the BU means you have to be yourself. And the bears are very bad at that, because if somebody says there is a honey down the street, they run.
And then they apologize later, and they're like, "Hey, man, you know it's not that easy. Please bear with me."
Oh my god! All right.
What is your problem, Florian? Do you think these jokes are unbearable to you? Or?
Yes. This podcast is my problem. So look. Heck.
But look, sorry. Yes, you have Beamon here, and you have Bearvik, so I don't know what your problem is. Just go with the flow.
Yeah, I'm going with the flow. I was actually trying to, like, sort of, like, now allocate the or locate the point in time when we met for the first time, because that was a maze then, and like I said, 2017, 18-ish. So at that point, you were here for quite some time.
Yes.
You've been doing research. You already finished, or were still researching?
I was finished, so I was looking for new land to conquer. Of course, in a peaceful way. And Berlin looked fantastic, and very lively. And especially kind of also to home in more on the production of something which helps me deal with the result of all that. Again, bear with me. I barely mentioned it beforehand. The result of the theoretical research I did was for me almost enough that I also had, I realized I had to go further, because, as I said, the brain is a fascinating organ. What it does, it is very good at pattern recognition. What it uses for that is, of course, perception, but as a stand-in and also conundrum in it, language. And we only can use language to kind of talk about it. And this language can be not just written word, but can be described in various different media, different sorts of media, which we use to communicate stuff in society in our society of brains. And to understand something, we use written words, images, sound, what have you, to convey some meaning. And so storytelling, as a result of that, is for me neuroscience, because we are changing our brains with that storytelling. If it's strong, it changes our memories. It changes the weight in our memories. It gives certain memories more value, more weight, and it creates something which we talked about it already, norms. It creates norms for ourselves, but it creates also visions. So especially about things which are not yet here.
There's something to be really said about that, because that's something I use a lot when I work with people, my friends or clients that I coach, that it's really about storytelling. It's like, you know, and I've also done this a lot of like work with myself on that. And that's like rewriting your own story. And you described it so nicely now. It was very nice to hear that you kind of give weight to different experience, or you kind of redistribute weight in your memories. That's entirely possible, right? It's like, you know, you are telling a story right now, and it's like, okay, what part of that story are you spending more time and words and descriptiveness on? And you're obviously leaving 99% of what's happening out, because you're compressing it into time, right? So, storytelling, as you know, neurological rewiring, is a very, very cool thing. And I mean, that's also what culture is, right? It's like kind of deciding which stories are being told right now. That's also what media, and by extent, just a quick connection to earlier, maybe media manipulation is, or,
of course,
well, preferential story. Storytelling is always preferential. Every story already has a kind of a value hierarchy built in, because you're telling, well, what you're telling, and you're not telling what you're not telling. So, yeah, that's fascinating to me. I'm glad you brought that up, and I just wanted to underline that part of the story, because I think that's very important.
Storytelling is the strongest tool we have to change reality.
True that.
/norms/normalities/ your perspectives on how the world works, or also
especially in the long term.
Yes,
because and that's why the pen is mightier than the sword, because the sword is obviously very mighty in this moment, because nobody with a chopped off head is going to tell a good story. But
depends on their reality.
Possibly, if you can retain your head, then you can use the pen and the word, and these things last, right? That's what books are, you know, artifacts of storytelling. Those that survive are the stories that are still relevant. Yeah, that there's a crazy, you know, ubiquitous nature to that.
True, and it's our only hope to change things. Of course, if you don't want to pick up the sword and just kind of create facts, and also these facts then need to be interpreted. So the chopped off head, as horrible that is, there can be attached different interpretations on why that happened, when that happened, how did it exactly happen, who held the sword, is it the right head, not to spin it. So we are getting, of course, into the realm of propaganda very quickly, and into the spin of it, and these kind of this profession we heard from in the last kind of 20-30 years the spin doctors who are doctoring stories, who are changing the meaning of things with the power of media, the money influence, probably repetition. And all that is kind of pestering our understanding of how the world works and how we understand ourselves too. And I got deeply appalled by this revelation that our world is being built on that, and nobody is kind of openly shows his disgust to say, mm-hmm. okay, we're on the level of storytelling, on the level yeah. of what do we tell each other, what kind of story is that, what kind of values are in there, what do you omit, what do you openly kind of underline, and so on and so on and so on. And I think that I put just the neuroscience, cognitive neuroscience, focus onto that, knowing that I'm changing profession deeply, to I have to listen to people who are good at storytelling. I have to listen to those who sit around the campfire, to listen to people who are writing and producing stories for a living, and also how to make them interactive then. For all this, Berlin looked like a good place to be.
Yeah. And look, talking about this, to me, it clearly puts me back into my... You also spoke about... neuroscience in the field of linguistics, of course. And then I studied English and American studies. So there's also, this part of course, looking at history and looking at different readings of history. And of course, we end up in postmodernism. And I think.
Do we end up in postmodernism, which is post already something? And do we have to post? And what comes after that?
In terms of. Yeah, in the curriculum of a German university at this point in time, we end up at postmodernism.
Because even if you're lucky if you are.
Yeah, well. But I mean, this is, it's fascinating to me because obviously there's a huge influx of postmodernist readings of everything now. And of course that
still is, really?
We can, wow. yeah, discuss cool. that. But to me, it's interesting because obviously you can also apply that to every different like field of studies. You can do that in literature. You can do that like asking these questions through a game, of course, and art. And then we come to people like you who started from a very, very different point, basically dissecting somebody's brain and like literally slicing through somebody's memories and then coming to this point of realization that these stories change reality, which again is somewhat a different approach, but also comes to this, in my mind, this thing of like, what is reality and how is it told afterwards by whoever omits or like you said, or tells what they feel like. And so like, I'm thinking of like, is there something to be said on your part, maybe because you've probably put more thought into this? I just did this while you were talking, like this, like a factual science in a way that is medicine. And then of course, like brain surgery, like things function a way they function. And then coming to this, well, do things function as they function? Is that what we are telling ourselves?
Mm-hmm. How we understand these things need to be put into language. I always refer back to that. Even if I'm writing a paper which explains the brain, if I would do that, the question is, can we do that in a different way than into a sequence of words, in a sort of linear way? Or do I need to, and now we're getting into other forms of expression, do I need to paint a picture? Do I need to put it into a video with some music in the background, which tells you exactly what I think the brain is? I think all these forms of expression are equally valid. No matter what some scientists or no matter what some artists say, who don't want to really venture too far into the other area, they are both valid. Are they both true? Okay, maybe we get back to sort of what truth could be, but I'm not even touching that. I'm just saying it's valid to kind of try that. You're probably failing anyways. We with this language, we are able to make our, as I say, affections, the emotions, our experiences, the sequence of it, the ways of it. We are trying to communicate this to other human beings who at a certain, maybe different moment in their lives, if it's a book, it can be read in 100 years, are getting sort of into the mindset of that language, of that kind of constructed architecture of text or the image or the moving picture. We in our minds simulated anew, meaning we are also into the business, definitely into the business of translation. So we are translating it. That's not a one-to-one. We are recreating it more or less in our own terms, meaning in our own concepts. So the base of it is language, but the underneath it, the subsymbolic order, there is, I think, there are concepts. And it's another word for something which we probably understand only partly. We have these kind of concepts of things which are fuzzy, which are not so one to one, which are not depicting for each of us the same thing, and that's quite liberating in parts. It's also quite scary in parts. I think that's very much what postmodern authors were working on. They kind of opened up language into poetry. They tried to be much more precise with language, which is less precise, getting beaten up by other philosophers who are probably simply not able to do that. But I think it's a worth and valid approach to find meaning in constructing something, in creating something. And here it's, for example, an architecture of words. You can call them a thousand plateaus. With Deleuze and Guattari, you could go into Derrida, you could kind of go to Baudrillard and the simulacra. Not just your hypothesis, the approach of seeing the world through that lens. And I think it's if you're interested in it, you find a lot of meaning which could tell you something in your life, in your moment of understanding the patterns approaching in front of you, or the ones you're searching. And if it's not postmodernism, you go back to history, maybe 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. Also, that is possible, and always, but always a translation, of course.
Mm-hmm. There's translation work going on all the time, and yeah, I think it's so interesting now that we are, as far as it seems to me, always having the job of creating culture and also transmitting culture, because culture meaning basically the set of words we use and we understand in the same way. This is something that
in a similar comparable way. Again, we probably cannot do this one to one, even though we love the illusion that we can, and we are pretty good at that. So we are pretty good at making that work, using things that work.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. What do you mean one to one? Because for example, you know, you used many words now that I didn't understand. And, you know, this is already a cultural, this is a, you know, cultural transmission task here, right? Maybe from academic to, I don't know, self-taught philosopher or whatnot. What I was getting at is that I think it's so cool and important to make up a set of language that is useful for many people, and to also use this language because that's what I heard you say, in different formats. For example, I think one of the best formats for that is music, because that really connects people super hard, because I don't know anything, for me personally, nothing transmits a feeling as well as a good song, you know?
Agreed.
Yeah. And so that's cool. And I wanted to ask you, I know, or as far as I know, you are working on games or a game that has very specifically, and it's a serious game, has a cultural transmission task. And I was wondering if you wanted to talk about this a bit. What is this? What are you making? What does it do? Why do we care?
The last question is highly important. And I agree that that we need to pose the question also to myself. Well, it's a palace. It's called a palace, but it's also a palace, at least parts of it.
It's called the palace.
Oh, palace.
Or just palace.
It's a prototype name. But quite literal. There is a palace involved. A Chinese palace imagined from 1,600 years ago, during the Three Kingdoms period. Imagined because those palaces don't exist anymore. And why to put it into a game? Well, because I conjured up that kind of conviction that it's still not ruled out that games are really so much worse in teaching something than books. Mm-hmm. I said it in a pointed way, because of course I think that they might be even better, but you have to do it right, and right means kind of, you know, an attempt to do it right. Serious games, as you said beforehand, also making the fun of it, the fun part, pointing to serious. Can games which are serious be fun? If you like learning, if you like serious things, probably that's also fun. And I think in serious games, seriousness isn't the major factor. They can be fun and should be fun also, please. That's one thing. On the other hand, kind of, well-designed serious games which teach adults something, are a sort of a rare field. Of course they exist, but you know, getting people to do different games than the blockbusters and different things, different concepts than the usual genres, that's already difficult. But with the motivation that they might also learn something, there is a possibility. And as I'm fascinated with the process of learning and how memory works, we end up in a game where you besides living through maybe a little story and a cultural background, you also learn to decipher or recognize Chinese characters more than you knew 10 minutes beforehand. Or let's say kind of, if the game is fully blown, you're in a prototype stage, it might be hundreds more. But
is that the main goal of the game to learn Chinese characters?
that would be great, but no. Why is it great? Because of course it would be great to kind of just learn through that. But if I take myself seriously with this in a serious game, I want to hopefully tell a story which people care about. And I think that's the tool in it. So if you are within a story with some agency where you are interested in see where that goes, then and you get maybe not even a blunt promise that you will learn something important for you, but you also learn that. I think I'm aiming at this kind of a moment where people realize that they learned besides playing the game, and not as a first kind of this is what you are going to learn, and now you have to turn the page. So the didactic point in it is storytelling.
And what is there to learn from let's say Chinese culture? If I hear you right,
a lot. A lot.
Yeah, and, please tell. I'm curious.
I'm not able to tell what there might be out after 5,000 years of cultural history, built up and lost in parts. It's I think an Herculean task to even put a little part out. You know, the mini part I might be able to put into a Western game, so not aimed for Chinese, to also convey some of the historic moments, maybe, which are then building up a setting, so that you are able to also learn some written Chinese through that setting. So it's a 3D game. It's not an open world, but it's a 3D world where you can walk around and where things might happen, which nurture you in your exploratory aims, exploratory willingness. And you are exploring like a kind of a walking simulator for a while. This were quite high grossing kind of game types to walk through things which teach you stuff too. And if you want to read more, you can read a little bit more, but not all too much. Knowing that this kind of worlds where knowledge is being conveyed, that this is a very tricky task. So it's many people have tried it. And I think, it depends highly on, the success depends highly on how does it look? How easygoing is it nevertheless, but also having depth nevertheless. All this together brings me to this prototype. So it's a computer games funded prototype to show exactly that this is possible and that it's fun and that people would care to kind of stay in there, at least for the prototype vertical slice time being.
Why are you making this game, and why do you care about it? Like this, I'm still curious about what there is. You know,
why the heck do I choose China and things I probably not got raised with, and how can I even dare to point there? yes, I'm not an expert in sinology. I haven't even lived in China for an extended period of time. I've visited several times. I had some ties there for a while. I fell in love with the cultural, meaning kind of personal people side of it. I mean, the people where I met, at least, were highly hospitable in ways which I've never seen before, and maybe after. Maybe in a moment when also the openness was a little bit higher. It was shortly after the Olympics, not the last ones, 2009, I think, a high point for every China watcher who kind of saw that there was a kind of very opening up. A lot of kind of Western journalists, less restrictions and so on. So people were kind of flocking in, and that still doesn't mean that I know anything, anything about that. But the little things I might kind of gotten.
It's about caring, not about knowing.
I care so much.
Nobody
about
knows exactly anything.
Yeah. Caring so much about that, I want to kind of put that into an experience. And what I'm also very much kind of touched by or inspired by is that playful experiences can have the biggest impact on memory, at least in what I experienced for myself. And I'm extending a little bit that might be also extended into games like kind of live action role playing games, LARPs, where it was the strongest for me. And the psychology behind it was deeply fascinating, or at least what we, tried to find out about it by playing it. In a video game, so here's not a LARP, it's a video game. I try to kind of put, all the knowledge I have, as little as it is, about kind of some parts of Chinese history and some parts of easy Chinese kind of writing together in ways so that it's kind of a joyful and positive experience for a Western adult. Building bridges through that. If you like that, you might understand a little part of it. Maybe you think you understood now everything, but of course, it's bullshit. I would not be, even if the game would be kind of 200 hours long, wouldn't convey a big part. But, you know, even if this event would be very, very, very long, and some people play a game, one game for 200 hours. I said a long time about World of Warcraft until I had a blister on my thigh, and then I gave up. So there are people who are very, very passionate about kind of being in a world, and if I can make somebody care about this kind of historical but also cyberpunk setting, because it doesn't stay historic in the end, then teaching some written Chinese, then this is the sort of that's the basic pitch. Showing if that works, that it's a powerful tool of adding much more in such games, and kind of taking it seriously, that there are that your world building, your universe you're creating, your details you're putting into it might be changing the connections in the players. I mean, the connections in their brains.
Do you first of all? If that was some NDA stuff, we will cut it out. Or if you drop that as a hint on purpose, I don't know about that cyberpunk stuff.
Also, no. I mean, after cyberpunk 2077, I no should probably not say cyberpunk, but I say it nevertheless. Kind of, I'm not CD Projekt Red. And if I could bring in at least kind of a quarter, a tenth of the quality in my mini kind of project in comparison, then I will be very happy. So don't worry. No. I will not talk about these things which are proprietary in ways. I think I'm fine. Don't worry.
Great. Something that like completely different topic in a way, but it connects to what you talked about right now for a while, because in that last segment, I think I counted four times when you specifically outright said or alluded to not knowing. And I think you are somebody who has thought about this like conundrum or about this not knowing a lot, or probably does still, because you mentioned it then in a like setting when you talk about basically experiences, and I mean you need some knowledge and experiences to do something. So what kind of like tickled me to ask was, do you get frustrated by knowing that you don't know?
No, I love it. I really love it. That is not a I hope it doesn't come across as a word in English which I'm missing now. It shouldn't sound coming from a high-nosed level. So I'm saying it because I'm meaning the contrary.
Not
sarcastic. There's a word which I'm missing now. What I think you get the meaning if I'm saying not how it sounds. I'm not loving it in sense of, in the end, I think I know a lot. Ha ha ha.
I was actually asking a serious question as well.
I know.
I got that. Yeah.
Here I say I know because I understood what you just said. Here I can be kind of precise because we are in this language game of saying, okay, what I think I understood what you said, therefore I can say yes to it. But in general, I think you got I'm very cautious with things I know. Mm-hmm. I'm sometimes not cautious with my opinion. Mm-hmm. Because, but I know that this is my opinion. I would not say I'm right, but I say, okay, this is now a strong opinion. Now you get kind of the half-baked kind of stuff I concocted up. Okay. But to be really sure that this is the case and nothing else, that would need really science behind it, and it would need science until it's kind of disproven by other science. So we are not kind of in a colloquial talk, we're not doing that. We're not kind of disproving each other with another kind of paper or with an experiment.
Although the internet seems to go that way.
Yeah, but I'd rather say I don't know. And because I really don't know. I mean, sorry. Yeah,
but that's refreshing. People can't do that often. Like, it takes some reflection to just not trying to. Maybe that's too much internet culture on my part. Yeah. But I feel like, I think we talked about social media at some point and all that stuff. People have a hard time just accepting that they don't know stuff. Mm. And still, and that being reason enough to not give an opinion.
Take the brain again. I could kind of come across now as a, you know, I'm an expert about the brain, about neurons, and the 100 billion or 90, whatever, a billion nerve cells in all our heads are doing this and this and that. It's so interesting. And there are these kind of papers up to say about say that, and these papers that say this. And in general, I think the brain is, and then I give you a formula. We could do that, but after my serious kind of attempt to understand something of the brain, I think I understood something, some parts. There's not nothing. I don't think, I started and now I'm just the wisdom tells me that I know nothing. That's for me a little bit too much of Sagan's folk philosophy. Or some people are rightfully pointing that out in history that we actually don't know shit. That is fine. It must be said sometimes, but we also I think we know something, but we just don't know how much of it.
Yep.
And that gets us into the devil's kitchen, because we sometimes point to it as if that's it, but it's never that. It might be a strange kind of perspective of the part you think is much more than it actually is, and other people then say, but I see how much away you are from that, so therefore it is different, and I give you my perspective. That's all fine. Let's engage in these kind of conversations that we are putting ourselves in, we are immersed in conversations about what is. I think that it comes from things which are not there. We are talking mostly about things which are not present. Especially when we are thinking about the more abstract concepts. So what we do then is having these conversations and still think that we talked about something. And that's fun. We can plan with that. No problem. We can also see if our plans come to fruition. At least, if we look at it and see what kind of parameters changed and whatnot. But in the end, not knowing is the norm, if you're honest. And I can work with that better. Not just working. It keeps the right kind of curiosity up. I also know certain things which I might not research until the end of days, which I think, okay, fine. I know how to walk a stair up. I will not research how the fuck that happened. Oh, how the beep happened that I could go up the 12 stairs with my body. That's kind of psychomotoric things which I learned as a child. That's not the things which interest me. I still do not know how I do that. Honestly, I don't know how. I cannot explain it to you. I need to kind of study that, but I can do it for you. I could walk up the stairs and you say, oh, great. He can do it. He's a valuable member of the class of people walking up the stairs.
I was very happy with your answer. Actually, I really liked this positive, point that you came to, like that's some kind of a motor or like an engine that keeps you curious and going, because I mean, yeah, you touched on it as well, like if you are in the wrong mind space, I think going too deep into this, well, I don't know anything, you can
sure.
go down a lot of rabbit holes and like not come out. And I think many people also do that somehow these days.
Could be also unhealthy to kind of doubt too much. Yes. It's a classic in epistemology. We call it solipsism. You're sort of doubting everything you know. Mm-hmm. Sort of, and nothing else is certain. So you kind of you isolate yourself from everything else. You're your own world because that's the only thing. Yeah, I exist as a kind of Descartes stance, where books have been written about how Descartes is wrong with that. Mm-hmm. I will not follow that trail, but in the Descartes era staying too much into your doubts of
yes.
also what's going on, what do you know really, what can you work with. I'm more practical in parts. I said, okay, we have to work with something. We can also put it into question theoretically, no problem, and we see where it ends, also with the mind itself and with also, you know, a game. But at the end, you know, we can ask Simon, and Simon says then, is it fun or not, do we care or not?
You know, for what example, does Simon say?
I don't know what Simon says. He said
Simon says it's fine.
Yeah, I hope
Simon says. Simon is wondering. Has been wondering if we are accepting our not knowing, which is what we just did, right?
Yeah.
What do we do about uncertainty, and especially? To tie it back to our opening topic, the fear of what an uncertain, not normal, all quote unquote, future might bring. Because for me, I don't have any fear at all. Honestly, I have to honestly report, I don't have any fear at all about the war, for example. Mm. Not that I don't think something bad might happen, but I'm not afraid because it's so highly uncertain that, like, all experiments for me seem futile. Like, all thought experiments, all possibilities seem futile. And by my philosophy, I don't know if it falls under solipsism or not, I have to do what I'm doing, you know. I feel like most people in the now war-torn regions do the same. You see them continuing by their day with a higher degree of suffering and so on. But that seems to be what carries people through, is the duty of the day, eating, breathing, and so on. So how do we reconcile, how do you reconcile, the not knowing and the contentment in not knowing, and then being faced with uncertainty and even the fear that you attested to yourself? I'm very curious about that.
I mean, you brought out today that the unknown and not knowing is sort of my thing. That's what I do. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And I seem to be happy with that. Isn't that strange? Okay, the unknown, I'm trying it, has... The unknown, we could have three approaches. You could either use science, find out in a methodological way. You get some answers which can be repeated and proven by other people, other human beings with their kind of instruments and experiments. So science is one option. Ignorance or divination. So you either ignore all that and you just kind of say, oh, I don't care what happens. I'll do what I want to do. Or you ask for the will of gods. Divination. You try to embrace what you really don't know. You even extrapolate and say, oh my God, there might be other forces behind. Let's ask them. Let's ask them what the future will bring. Mm-hmm. And I find the last one especially interesting because they encompass usually kind of super interesting cultural storytelling. Usually yeah. You go back to the origins of where we come from, who we are, so the five Kantian questions, in the end two, we get into belief systems, and they are called belief because we don't prove them, we say we believe. And divination is in big parts, or at least in the mechanics, sometimes connected to games. I can segue here and into the game project I have, because a part of it deals with a system of divination to as a game mechanic to help get forward into a realm you don't know anything about. And it might help also as a tool for storytelling. And it's also something in general, the approach is not something I invented by myself. There are systems of divinations the Romans used. There is the Roman augury. When you look at how many birds are flying at a certain kind of moment, we have the Greek geomancy, where you kind of read the future from fallen sand or earth or structures of stones. We have the Western African Ifa system, which is a more kind of already kind of in the direction of more board game like a little bit. And some people kind of looked into the entrails of animals, the haruspices, or into how the liver looks in sheep or poultry. Yes, that all sounds like kind of helpless, superstitious fortune telling. But what is fortune? What is we want to know from the future? Usually the answer is we want storytelling which keeps us going or makes the unknown bearable. No pun intended now. so we try to control our destiny with it. The Book of Changes, the I Ching in China, one of the oldest systems.
Now you're bringing it up. We're almost done. Now you're bringing it up.
One of my main fields of study. I was so interested. I tried
so the book. Some say it shouldn't be an oracle book. It should be a book of wisdom. You know, it was partly used then to go away from a more divination part from being a mage, being a priest to foretell the future into some kind of state theories to also use it for how to run a state properly. As Simon, I think, is very well aware of the highly influential translations in German by Richard Wilhelm are in parts kind of putting a Western mind into the shoes of somebody of 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, written, of course, then later on, but into a practice of rituals to kind of find out what the future beholds. And that's still in our scientific times highly interesting, and I think it's still valid, especially if you're a playful type, and especially if you are daring to say, well, you know, I give some control now to the dice, especially if the dice are kind of made to, or designed, evilly designed, of course, to into some outcomes of a certain value, of a certain kind of direction. And I think to what I would suggest is to others have done this I'm sure to look also onto a divination system like kind of the I Ching, not just in terms of wisdom but onto a game onto the aspects of game design. What is it designed to do? Who came up with that in sense of to create significance, to create meaning, to be so highly influential that this system has changed the lives or decisions in a certain kind of point in time of literally kind of millions of people. And I'm fascinated by that, and I think Simon too.
I am. I want to talk about something related to the I Ching. I don't know what. Can you do me a favor and ask me something about it that you want to know, maybe?
Let's put it like this. How much do you trust a system from a different culture which is maybe thousands of years old to be meaningful in your current life circumstances? How do you manage that?
Yeah. Okay, so... Great question. First of all, the I Ching is very well translated by a very trustworthy guy, Richard Wilhelm. And so he did a good job of putting those ancient Chinese words into understandable German words, who are evocative of the esoteric, but they are still very understandable and relatable. So that's a great start. You know, there's a great cultural transfer that has happened, and that is proper. Otherwise, you know, I couldn't vibe with it. You know, that would be difficult. So that's a really great start. And I guess to briefly explain what the I Ching is, it is called the Book of Changes, and it contains 64 signs made out of 6 lines each. If you look at the South Korean flag, it has these 4 trigrams, which stand for heaven, earth, fire, and water. And each I Ching sign is made out of 2 of those trigrams. So that's probably the most, or like if you look into a dojo or something, you see these lines that they represent these symbols that stand for the I Ching. And then you throw coins and you get the lines, and you basically often get 2 signs. When you like ask the oracle, you throw 3 coins 6 times, you get 6 lines, and some of them change, and then you get 2 signs. So you get a 1 sign that kind of, depending on your interpretation, that represents the current state, let's say, because you're asking a question, right? What's the best thing for me to do about the difficult situation in Europe? Pretty big question, but that's something you could ask. And then, or maybe it's, you know, what should I do about this girl that I'm texting who doesn't text me back? You know, also a good question to ask.
Both questions, nothing. I just tried it here.
Yeah, nothing?
Yes.
Nothing.
Okay.
That's do nothing. Do more nothing.
Yeah, do more of nothing. Exactly. Quick throws, man. And so, and then you get like 1 sign of the current state, maybe, and then the change, what it may change to, depending on your behavior. So that's the quick explanation of how this divination in particular works. I find it very practical. And so your question was, how do I manage that, the importance of that, or how that might relate to my life? Also given that it's from a foreign culture, right?
And yeah. Years.
Thousands of years and translation in between.
Exactly. Well, actually, I think the last point is very very good because I like old things. I like timeless things, and I like things. I always say, you know, these texts, they're like sharp and well-made knives. You know, they're folded. They've been edited, folded, and then sharpened, so lots of layers and lots of removals. And so they have an essential nature to them. I find that very interesting. And
do you just fold from old shit from history and make it your own personal metaverse? Congratulations. This is how our mind works.
Mm-hmm. And then the
sorry for the sarcasm. I didn't mean it to be sound meaning.
No worries. It's obviously true. I mean, there's obviously, but to the rest of the question, I haven't found something that resonates so much with me. So I don't feel like I'm bound to a particular culture with this, and I'm very happy that that. Like I can relate a lot to like Christianity, and you know that's also divination in a way, or relating to the divine. But
especially
I really like
Christian mysticism. Yeah,
I really like the Tao and this language. You know, I think, and that's really what it's about. And that's the first thing I said. So I could have left it at that if this were a podcast where people speak in short intervals. The language is good. The language is just right. It's just hitting the right spot. And, you know, it's also about understanding. You asked about managing. It's about understanding what is happening here. You know, you're not getting exact, you're getting pretty concrete advice on how to act. But you also understand that life happens anyway. And there's a, there's kind of a, it gives you a an insight, and you can, and it can kind of make the meaning web around that topic that you're asking about a bit more dense. And then I also have, and I will end on this, I have experience with this, where I've made I Ching throws, so kind of like units of divination with people, with friends. And even years later, I remember the throw, the question, and they too. And it kind of, there's meaning that was accessed at this point in time where we studied that and did that, that doesn't get lost. And I think that's extremely valuable and hard to come by, like a persistence of meaning. You know, I remember when I made the I Ching throw with my brother, and the question was this, and the result was this, and now we can still reference that. It's almost like the moment you do this throw and you both kind of buy into it, people gain a little piece of culture, a little piece of shared language that is shorthand for something incredibly complex and interesting, and also a beautiful moment of togetherness and time.
Sure, exactly, a ritual.
So that's all the great things about it. That's how I feel about it.
Very, very interesting. Thank you for sharing that fascination. May I kind of just comment one or two things?
Yeah.
It seems that you,
and then we have to wrap up, by the way.
Sure.
But
it seems that you trust the teller and not the tale. So you are quote a friend of mine who came up with that: trust the teller, not the tale. The person Richard Wilhelm is important for you to make the translation happen. Otherwise, it might be kind of inaccessible if you cannot read the Chinese texts in the original. You need somebody to kind of give you access through language.
That is for sure.
The fascination I share, it comes also from my side. As you heard I didn't put the scientific mindset out with the scientific bathtub and the babies kind of going out in addition. So I'm still fascinated by this, knowing that what we do with these systems is telling us a particular story, making a certain moment memorable. I don't think that I think we are creating meaning through it. And that is fine, because that is also a decision. You're making a decision through this ritual. And you can say, oh, I don't need any of these things. So I can make just a decision without that. Yeah, but it's less fun. and maybe less absolutely memorable.
Absolutely.
So to
it's
give
a totally up, great game.
Yeah, because you wouldn't play it because you play with your fate somehow. I mean, you can say kind of, I go down this road. Now I throw a coin. You could also use your observational talents and see kind of which kind of path is more interesting, leading to probably up the hill or down the hill to this castle or to that orc. You just throw a coin. And you either die or not going down that road. So there's quite a lot at stake. And it could be either looking foolish or very brave to do so. So to use that a system, something else, trust that this will be fine then, because you could have also made a conscious decision and say, no, I'm weighing all the eventualities and I'm doing this then. With a divination system, you somehow give it up. But
you don't. No, you don't. Because your actions, you still have to act. You know, this is like an additional article you read on a topic, you know, and then you, and I think the correct way to access this as well is the Bruce Lee way. It's like you take what resonates and what's good for you, and the rest you just leave. I mean, there's a total subjective, idiotic selectivity about it. Yeah,
I see.
Like you don't have to buy the whole fucking thing just because, you know, it's there. It's like, plenty of times you can just say, ah, shut up, I Ching, you know, I don't even know why I asked you, you know, and then what might happen that you come back to that and you reread the thing 7 months later and you're like, ah, you were right again, you know, but this is all subjectivity. And for me, that's part of the rules of the game. You got to know that in divination, you know, for me, like you know, I'm not an absolutist about this at all. Like, mm-hmm. But yeah, that's a whole another conversation. I mean, but yeah, I don't think you give it up. I think you gain some optionality. Yeah, depending on how serious you would take it, I would say.
And you gain back some control, nevertheless, because you then believe that, that's what you do. And I love this in games too, to have the promise that something will work out somehow with it. So you are inside of this kind of consensual space. In live action role playing, we at least in the Nordic LARP viewpoint, there is a lot of talk about kind of the magic circle. You are either entering it consensually. And then you are in the game, or you're stepping out of it again. So then all the rules of inside of the game don't apply anymore. You're in a safe space, but you have to do that. And that is a physical thing to do. You have to throw then the dice. You have to then take your tokens, throw them to find out what it is. And you also, because you're inside of the magic circle, you promised to somehow kind of take it seriously enough. Otherwise, there's no need to play that.
Mm-hmm. And for me, that's really the thing about so many things, so many games, so many rituals. You know, I mean, this podcast is a ritual. You know, we like, as soon as this is over, we will talk to each other in a different way. But now we can't. Like that's just how it is. And it's the same with, and that's a beautiful thing. And that's why I find it super legit to call this a game. And when I offer, you know, hey, should I throw an I Ching for you to somebody? Then I ask, you know, consent, basically, not very explicitly, but kind of like three times. It's like, well, should we play this? And you want to do this? And I explain to them what's going to happen. But when we do it, that will happen, you know. And there is a portal of, you know, let's say 45 minutes that then will be allocated to that. And it will include, you know, me reading this thing and, you know, me playing the game the way I play it with somebody. And that's what I experience every time I do this, whether I do a podcast or whether I do throw an I Ching with somebody or whether I have a coaching session with somebody. There's always this stepping into the magic circle and kind of, yeah, kind of this consent, this coming together, that's already half the rent, you know, that's already,
I agree.
Makes
consent.
The magic.
Exactly.
That makes the magic. And then, you know, and if somebody would be distraught and be like, well, you know, and their, you know, biophysiological system would be somehow revolting, I would say, well, maybe not, right? Like maybe the divination today is the weather is too bad, you know, let's stop, right? But going, making the decision together to go there in any game, so much magic happens there, you know? And
I agree.
And, you know, I think that's also so important about this. It's like, you know, do you believe in magic? Like, don't you want to have the fun of believing in magic? Don't you want to experience a bit of magic? Like any LARPer can, like I have a friend, my ex-colleague Flips at Twitch who does basically works at Twitch full time. And when he has free time, he just goes LARP. And when he tells me these
LARP,
stories,
this is great. He just goes totally LARP.
He goes LARP all the way. Mm-hmm. And dude, like when he tells me these stories from his literal adventures, I'm like, fuck, you know, it has a psychedelic effect on me, right? It's like,
also on you.
Oh my God, I can't believe you're experiencing this, you know? And for me, it's also hilarious because last time we did it, there was a time where I was thinking about how I should live my life. And I was almost like, I should just LARP more in my life. You know, I should just act more. I just should play more games, you know, because what you're doing in your LARP is basically what I want to do in my life, you know, is life if not an action role play? You know, there was a total like shift in reality. So just the tale contains the magic, you know, and that's already a game being told a story. So yeah, I think, yeah, well, that sums up a lot of gaming stuff and also, you know, divination. For me, there's no difference. With a bit of a winky eye and some willingness to play and some fun and joy, all these things can be great. Like, I see little reason for cynicism there. You know, as long as we don't hurt anybody actively, right?
If you have ever been a refugee on a ship of the colonial fleet and getting nuked out of the sky around Elysium Omega because you made the wrong decisions or your decisions didn't matter and you died there in the story world of Battlestar Galactica, being played out as a 3 days Nordic LARP at a Swedish destroyer in Gothenburg, then I would not want to really live that in my life, but I love it that this is possible, that you can live it emotionally with people who create this experience for real in our world, and you can step into it and feel the turmoil of these situations, feel the cold of the steel as if it's in space, to feel as if you died because there were things were in vain. And everybody has its own story then to tell. And the bleed, I mean, the LARP term or Nordic LARP term for kind of this emotional bleeding of emotions from the character into the player or from the player into the character, which goes both directions, is so interesting because it, like a drug, it goes on for weeks. You can have flashbacks. Yeah. I had a flashback on my vacation in Greece. No, it was in Italy, actually, on a ferry where I saw a red telephone. I said, oh my God, there will be the captain will be calling and we'll get boarded soon. All the emotions were back because I saw this damned kind of phone and it was on a ship. And suddenly, even though it was the brightest kind of summer day and was warm, everything came back. So that's heavy. That's heavy and interesting and strong stuff. I'm deeply convinced that these kind of experiences are very informative and very kind of fruitful. They're a little bit wacky, of course. They might cost money to make that happen. It needs time and commitment. Like kind of stepping into a designed video game environment, if it's done well, it captures you, it catches you, and it grows a certain kind of experience which you would not have outside of it. And that is culture being kind of created by people. And yeah, I think that's what's awesome in all these kind of proliferating fields and intersections, trying to kind of tell people or give people a magic circle where they can tell themselves something about themselves or the world, or where they can come back with different memories and a new, maybe a little bit new, changed weighing of their values.
Yes. Yes, and I hope I won't give you flashbacks now, but we will now nuke this interview into oblivion. No, PTSD. Yeah, thank you for that. We have we end these podcast interviews with questions we consider essential because we're at a time limit. These are going to be quick fire. So fire short, fire quick, okay? Do you agree to the game? Do you step into the mystic circle with us? The game within the
consent.
Game? Consent has been given. Okay, essential question number one. What inspires you?
Any kind of storytelling, especially serial, meaning kind of long-term. Long-term means kind of a short story could be a joke, but I mean hours and hours of world-building with characters. That inspires me.
What is the purpose of your being?
Breathing, eating, pattern recognition.
We know it. What's a beautiful day to you?
When it rains.
What is the change you want to see in the world?
More sunshine into the hearts of people, please, and more peace.
And how do you contribute to that?
creating meaningful stories for others, engaging in conversations which create positive change, and all that loaded up by really wanting that honestly and not just as a kind of professional positioning and branding. Some do that. I'm just kind of annoyed after all this that we really need that. We need people to come up and engage and push for the right things to happen, as far as we know, right? And to engage in that somehow as good as I can, that would be it.
If you would start a new safe game in your life now, what occupation would your new character have?
What do you mean safe game? A game which I can save with save points?
Yeah, if you would like have a new game plus or something, you know, you start your
totally
life.
Totally new life.
A new. A new save, yeah. What occupation would your new character have?
Monk in Tibet.
Nice. Do you have any books that you often recommend and that you would like to recommend to the listeners or to us?
Oh, yeah.
1, 2, 3.
1, 2, 3. Okay. Yeah, read the whole Dune cycle, 1 to 6, not just the first three. I just read them again in the pandemic lockdowns. It's just kind of fantastic, also from the environmental standpoint of how planetary things could work out and politics, fantastic. And the vision point of it. So we have Dune, Frank Herbert. I put Neal Stephenson's Diamond Age onto it, even though the book itself didn't kind of blast through so much, but the themes. There is a particular token, a book in there, which is very, very kind of close to what I'd like to kind of aim my work at. So Diamond Age, Neal Stephenson, and the third. What do we do with the third? We have it. And can it be German too?
Of course.
Okay, it's Austrian. Stefan Zweig, Die Welt von gestern. Stefan Zweig, the world of yesterday. Erinnerungen eines Europäers, Memories of a European. Zweig's last book before he killed himself in South America. He made sort of an account of why he thinks himself being a protagonist of a world which went down the drains with the Second World War, and where with that I could relate a lot, and it tells a lot about the last, let's say, kind of 80-90 years and European culture. So
It is indeed called the world of yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah. So now is my turn. What are your favorite games? Also, 1, 2, 3.
Okay, 1, 2, 3. What do we put first?
You don't have to like rank them. It's just like you can give us 1, 2, 3 options.
Okay. Zack McCracken, C64, a classic, number two would be, Heavy Rain from Quantum. Storytelling wise, still an interesting way of trying to get cinematic storytelling done in a game. It's not an open world, but yeah, that's so Heavy Rain. And the third would be, what do we take? Let's call it a checkers board game. Simple. Play with your kids.
All right. Who is somebody from the games industry, or let's say wider games industry, who you would like to get to know?
Okay. who I'd like to get to know. Well, yeah, I'm saying it, even though this, the games industry kind of fringes and you would not like me for that. I'm just would ask him some moral questions. and Palmalaki, Oculus, founder, who is now working on Anduril, an AI startup for defense contractors. So he's working for the military. And I would sit down and really ask the guy some kind of questions about it. Of course, I would not be able to do so. They would probably kind of, not let me.
All right. Since the project this podcast belongs to, Games at Berlin Europe, is about connecting people, we thought it would be a fun challenge to try and do what we just asked you. So basically, we will actually somehow try to reach out and get you your answers and connect you to that person. So,
oh really?
We will let you know how that goes. That's our challenge.
The guy got kicked out of Facebook, so kind of maybe he's open for a talk here and there, coffee table talk. I don't know. Okay, great. What an incredibly a generous and interesting offer. Thank you.
And that's the mechanic of the question as well. So we give that to every guest.
I didn't say consent, but I'm very happy. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Game without
consent. I mean, you started at the beginning. You said consent. I can clearly remember. We can,
we can
to the game within the game, but not to the game within the game within the game.
Oh, I see.
Exactly.
I see. Okay, then. Who is someone you know who you think we should have on the podcast?
I was expecting a little bit. I was thinking already. You should. I think out of the people and I know who are kind of cozy and have something to say, and also are deeply. I just like the forward storytellers. You might know, being around in the Berlin kind of games net for quite a while, would be Nico Nonne.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's also kind of, he was trying to kind of get storytelling as a kind of. As a product actually out there, and he's seasoned, so he had some time to get into the ups and downs of that kind of volatile genre, volatile kind of sector, and I think Nico would be very cozy and also broad.
Okay, and last but not least, where can people find you? And that is a question that means online. Don't tell people your exact location, please.
So again, okay, the connections online. Well, you mean anything, the website
your accounts, Twitter, Facebook, okay. LinkedIn, website?
I see. So there is the easy peasy cheesy new way how to do that. I mean, new, it's not so new. And that is Linktree. So I give you the this particular Linktree. It would be
here. We can post it in the show notes after. So if you have all your stuff in there.
Point dot EE. So the Linktree stuff / and then we have the hack with underscores h_e_c_k. There you find all the rest. And now it became really, really useful. I wasn't quite sure if to follow the masses of people who moved all their kind of stuff to Linktree, but now I know why.
Yeah, all in one place, eh?
Exactly.
Very nice.
Bonus question. What color socks do bears wear?
Brown ones, because they are very funny.
None, because they usually have bare feet.
You're really ending it with a bear joke.
It's fantastic. I had it open for half an hour now, like anticipating this exact moment. It's also a list of like 53 of them, and I was thinking all the time, which one are you going to choose?
We love Florian for his bearing with the bears and just giving them another more exposure. I think we need to kind of honor that.
I think he represents a great way of being. Thank you for talking to us, man. This was very interesting. And thanks for talking to me about the I Ching in the last moment. I'm grateful that it happened.
I'm very happy that our conversation here turned out to be kind of also enjoyable and happy for me, and that there were so many bears mentioned. I hope that something kind of halfway reasonable or hope. Caring and fun comes out of that for people who listen to this. And thank you for all the work you put into this podcast. So I think all the stuff going on in the background with also Anne and your team is to be underlined, and any guest is kind of on top of that, meaning kind of supported by this. And thank you for making it happen and bringing out interesting stories to people who are thinking that games are more than just playing.
Appreciate
you very
that.
Much.
Thank you.
Have
a great day. Have a beautiful
day. You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi there, Simon here. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you like what you hear here and you would like to hear more here, feel free to follow or to subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform you get your audio fix. We appreciate you, and we promise you to bring you many more insightful conversations with fantastic games industry guests from Berlin and from all over Europe. Thank you very much, and see you very soon. Bye-bye.
Hi there. Before you go, this is Florian, project manager for GamesNet Berlin Europe. If you want to stay connected to the network, find out more about upcoming events and links to other MediaNet initiatives, you can visit us at gamesnetberlin.eu and subscribe to our newsletter. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast, and until next time.